lay my blessing upon you. Bar Shalem Ramos. My son did not move from his couch or say a word, and I took my leave, broken-hearted but free. Chapter 5. Returning home was like being reborn. I buried my face in the bed linens and ran my hands over every piece of furniture, every garden plant, delighted to find things where I had left them. Kia walked in to find me embracing a water jug. I sent her to tell Merritt I was home, and then walked as fast as I could to Benia's workshop. My husband saw me approach and rushed out to greet me. It seemed that we had been parted for years rather than days. "You are so thin, wife," he whispered as he held me in his arms. "I fell ill in the city," I explained, "but I am healthy again." We studied each other's faces. "Something else happened," Benia said, drawing his fingers across my forehead and reading something of the past day's shocks. "Are you back to stay, beloved?" he asked, and I understood the cause of the shadows beneath his eyes. I reassured him with an embrace that earned us a loud hoot from the men in the workshop. "I will be home as soon as I can," he said, kissing my hands. I nodded, too happy to say more. Merritt was waiting with warm bread and beer when I returned to my house, but when she saw me, she cried, "What did they do to you, sister? You are skinny as a bone, and your eyes look as though you have wept a river." I told my friend about the fever and of Ramos's quarrel with his master. When my friend heard that he was posted to the north, her eyes filled in sympathy. After we ate what Merritt had brought, she ordered me to the bed and massaged my feet. All the pain of the past weeks melted as she kneaded my toes and cradled my heels. After I was at peace and still, I asked her to sit by my side, and I took her hand, still warm and moist with oil, and told her the rest of what happened to me in Thebes, including how it came to pass that Zaphnat Paneach, the king's right hand, was my brother, Joseph. Merritt listened in stillness, watching my face as I recounted my mother's history and the story of Shechem and the murder of Shalem. My friend did not move or utter a sound, but her face revealed the workings of her heart, showing me horror, rage, sympathy, compassion. When I finished, she shook her head. "I see why you did not tell me this before," she said sadly. "I wish I had been able to help you bear this burden from the very first. But now that you entrust your past to my keeping, it is safe. I know you need no oath from me, or else you would not have told me." "Dear one," she said, putting my hand to her cheek, "I am so honored to be the vessel into which you pour this story of pain and strength. For all these years, no daughter could have made me happier or more proud than you. Now that I know who you are and what life has cost you, I am in awe that I number you among my beloved." After a comfortable silence, Merritt gathered her things and prepared to leave. "I will go to give you time to prepare for Benia's arrival," she said, taking my two hands in hers. "Blessings of Isis, blessings of Hathor, blessings of the mothers of your house." But before she walked out the door, my friend's face regained its impish grin, and with a friendly leer she said, "I will call upon you tomorrow. See if you can't get off your back long enough between now and then to make me something to eat for a change, eh?" Benia ran in soon after, and we fell upon the unmade bed like youthful lovers, breathless and hurried. Afterward, knotted in each other's clothes, we slept the famished sleep of reunited lovers. I awoke once in the night, startled and smiling, hating to close my eyes upon the joy of being home. After my return, I never fully lost my reverence for ordinary pleasures. I arose before Benia to study his face and breathed silent prayers of thanks. Walking to the water fountain or pulling weeds in the garden, I was overcome by the understanding that I had spent a whole day without the weight of the past crushing my heart. Birdsong brought me to tears, and every sunrise seemed a gift shaped for my eyes. When the vizier's messenger arrived at our door, as I knew he would some day, I froze with dread at the thought of leaving for so much as a day, but to my relief, the letter did not summon me to the great house on the east bank. Joseph's dream had been fulfilled, and a second son was born to him. This one came so fast, however, that Asnath did not have time to send for me before the one called Ephraim found his way into the world. Even though I had rendered him no service, Zaphnath Paneach sent a gift of 3 lengths of snowy linen. When Benaiah asked me why the gift was so extravagant, I told him everything. It was the third time I had given voice to the full story, first to Werenroe, then to Merritt. But this time, my heart did not pound, nor my eyes fill as I told it. It was only a story from the distant past. After hearing me out, Benaiah took me in his arms to comfort me, and I nestled into the sheltering peace between Benaiah's hands and his beating heart. Benaiah was the rock upon which my life stood firm, and Merritt was my wellspring. But my friend was older than I by a generation, and age was taking its toll. The last of her teeth had fallen from her mouth, for which she claimed herself grateful. "No more pain," she chuckled. "No more meat, either," she said, with a doleful shrug. But her daughter-in-law, Shifrey, chopped and mashed every dish, and my friend remained hearty and enjoyed her beer and her jokes as much as ever. She attended many births with me, taking delight in newborn smiles, weeping over the deaths that came our way. We shared countless meals, and I always left her table chuckling. We knew her days were numbered, and kissed each other goodbye at every parting. Nothing between us was left unsaid. The morning came when Kia appeared at the door to say that Merritt could not rise from her bed. "I am here, dear one, sister," I said when I arrived at her side. But my old friend could no longer give me greeting. She could not move at all. The right side of her face had collapsed, and her breathing was labored. She returned the pressure of my fingers in her left hand and blinked at me. "Oh, sister," I said, trying not to weep. She stirred, and I could see that even though she was nearing death, Merritt was trying to comfort me. That would not do. I looked into her eyes and managed a midwife's smile. I knew my task. "Fear not," I whispered. "The time is coming. Fear not, your bones are strong. Fear not, good friend, help is nearby. Fear not, Anubis is a gentle companion. Fear not, the hands of the midwife are clever. Fear not, the earth is beneath you. Fear not, little mother. Fear not, mother of us all." Merritt relaxed and closed her eyes, surrounded by sons and daughters, grandsons and granddaughters. She sighed one long sigh. The wind threw reeds and left us. I joined with the women in the high-pitched, keening death song that alerted the whole neighborhood to the passing of the beloved midwife, mother, and friend. Children burst into tears at the sound, and men rubbed their eyes with damp fists. I was heartbroken, but comforted by one of Merritt's last gifts to me, for at her deathbed, I became one of her grieving family. Indeed, I was treated as the oldest female relative and given the honor of washing her withered arms and legs. I swaddled her in Egypt's finest linen, which was mine to give. I arranged her limbs in the crouch of a baby about to enter the world and sat with her through the night. At dawn, we carried her to rest in a cave on a hill overlooking the tombs of kings and queens. Her sons buried her with her necklaces and rings. Her daughters buried her with her spindle, her alabaster bowl, and other things she loved. But the midwife's kit had no place in the next life, and it passed to the keeping of Shifrey, who held Merritt's tools with reverence, as though they were made of gold. We buried Merritt with songs and tears, and on the way home, laughed in her honor, recalling her delight in surprises, jokes, food, and all the pleasures of the flesh. I hoped that she would continue her enjoyment of these in the life to come, which she believed to be much like this world, only deathless and eternal. That night, I dreamed of Merritt and woke up, laughing at something she said. The following night, I dreamed of Bilha, waking to tears on my cheeks that tasted of the spices my aunt used in her cooking. One night later, Zilpa greeted me, and we flew through the night sky, a pair of she-hawks. When the sun set again, I knew I would meet with Rachel in dreams. She was as beautiful as I remembered. We ran through a warm rain that washed me clean as a baby, and I woke up smelling as though I had bathed in well water. Eagerly, I awaited my dream of Leah, but she did not come the next night, or the night after. Only at the dark of the new moon was I visited by the mother of my flesh. It was the first time my body failed to give the moon her due. I was past giving life, and my mother, who had borne so many children, came to comfort me. "You are the old one now," she said gently. "You are the grandmother, giving voice to wisdom. Honor to you," my mother Leah said, touching her forehead to the ground before me, asking forgiveness. I lifted her up, and she turned into a swaddling baby. Holding her in my arms, I begged her pardon for ever doubting her love, and I felt her pardon in the fullness of my heart. I went to Merritt's tomb the morning after Leah's dream and poured out wine, thanking her for sending my mothers back to me. With Merritt gone, I was the wise woman, the mother, grandmother, and even great-grandmother of those around me. Shefray, a new grandmother, and Kia, about to be married, attended me wherever I went to place the bricks. They learned what I had to teach, and soon went on their own to deliver women from the fear and loneliness of birth. My apprentices became sister and daughter. In them, I found new water in the well I thought would remain forever dry after my Merritt died. Months passed, and years. My days were busy, my nights peaceful. But there is no lasting peace before the grave. And one night, after Benia and I had gone to bed, Joseph appeared inside our door. The sight of him there, clad in a long black cloak that turned him into a shadow, was so strange that I thought him part of a dream. But the edge in my husband's voice woke me to the moment, suddenly dark and dangerous. "Who comes into my house without knocking?" he growled, like a dog sensing danger, for this was clearly no distraught father in search of the midwife. "It is Joseph," I whispered. I lit lamps, and Benia offered my brother the best chair. But Joseph insisted on following me back to the kitchen, where I poured him a cup of beer, which sat untouched. The silence was thick and stiff. Benia's hands were clenched, for he was fearful that I was about to be taken from him. His jaw was locked, for he was unsure how to speak to the noble perched on a stool in his kitchen. Joseph sent me glances full of unspoken urgency, for he was unwilling to speak in front of Benia. I looked from one face to the other and realized how old we had grown. Finally, I told Joseph, "Benia is your brother now. Say what it is you came to say." "It's Daddy," he said, using a baby word that I had not heard since Canaan. "He is dying, and we must go to him." Benia snorted in disgust. "How dare you?" Joseph said, jumping to his feet and putting his hand on the dagger at his side. "How dare you?" Benia replied, with equal passion, stepping closer. "Why should my wife weep by the bedside of a father who murdered her happiness and his own honor? A father who sent you to the long knives of men known for their ruthlessness?" "You know the story, then," said Joseph, suddenly defeated. He sat down and put his head in his hands and groaned. They sent me word from the north where my brothers and their sons tend the flocks of Egypt. Judah says that our father will not live out the season, and that Jacob wishes to give my sons his blessing. I do not wish to go, Joseph said, looking at me as though I had some answer for him. I thought I had finished with my duty there. I thought I had even forgiven my father, though not without exacting a price. When they came to my house starving and seeking refuge, I twisted the knife. I accused them of theft and forced them to grovel before the mighty Zaphnat Paneach. I watched Levi and Simon put their foreheads to the ground at my feet and tremble. I gloated and sent them back to Jacob, demanding Benjamin be sent. I punished our father for choosing favorites. I punished my brothers, too, and kept them in fear of their lives. Now the old man wishes to place his hands on the heads of my boys, to choose them for his blessing. Not the sons of Reuben or Judah, who have supported him all these years and borne his moods and whims, not even the sons of Benjamin, the last born. I know Jacob's heart. He wishes to atone for the wrongs of the past by blessing my sons. But I fear for them with such a birthright. They will inherit tormenting memories and strange dreams. They will come to hate my name. Joseph railed on as Benaiah and I listened. The hurts of the past clung to him, caught in the folds of his long dark cloak. He flailed around like a drowning lamb. As he talked about fat years and lean years, about loneliness and sleepless nights, about how life had treated him so cruelly, I searched for the brother I remembered, the playfellow who listened to the words of women with respect and who once looked at me as his friend. But I saw nothing of that boy in the self-absorbed man before me, whose mood and voice seemed to change from moment to unhappy moment. "I am a weakling," said Joseph. "My anger has not abated, and I have no pity in my heart for Jacob, who has become blind like his father before him. And yet, I cannot say no to him." "Messages get lost," I said softly. "Messengers are sometimes waylaid." "No," said Joseph, "that lie would finally kill me. If I do not go, he will haunt me forever." "I will go, and you will come with me," said Joseph, suddenly shrill, a man accustomed to power. I did not try to hide my disgust at his tone, and when he saw my contempt, he dropped his head in shame. And then my brother bowed down with his forehead on the dirt floor of the carpenter's kitchen and apologized to me and to Benaiah too. "Forgive me, sister. Forgive me, brother. I do not wish to see my father dying. I do not wish to see him at all, and yet I cannot disobey. It is true that I can force you to go with me, and for no other reason than to hold my hand, but you will prosper in this too." He stood and resumed the demeanor of Zaphnat Paneach. "You will be my guests," he said smoothly. "The master carpenter will do business on behalf of the king. I go to purchase timber in the north, and I require the services of an artist who knows how to select the finest wood. You will go to the marketplace of Memphis and see olive, oak, and pine in abundance, choosing only what belongs in the king's house and tomb. You will bring honor to your profession and to your own name." His words were seductive, but Benaiah looked only at me. Then Joseph brought his face close to mine and gently said, "Ahati, this is your last chance to see the fruits of your mother's wombs, their grandsons and granddaughters. For those are not only the children of Jacob, they are also the children of Leah, Rachel, Zilpah, and Bilhah. You are the only aunt of their mother's blood, and our mothers would wish for you to see their granddaughters. After all, you are the only daughter, the one they loved." My brother could talk the wings off a bird, and he talked until the sun rose, and Benaiah and I were exhausted. Although we never said yes, there was no saying no to Zaphnat Paneach, the king's vizier, just as there had been no saying no to Joseph, son of Rachel, grandson of Rebekah. We left with him in the morning. At the river, we were met by a bark of surpassing luxury, filled with chairs and beds, painted plates and cups, sweet wine and fresh beer. There were flowers and fruit everywhere. Benia was stunned at the riches, and neither of us could look into the faces of the naked slaves who waited upon us with the same servility they showed Zafnat and his two sons and their noble retinue. The lads were old enough to grow their hair, and they were good boys, curious about their father's guests, but polite enough not to ask questions. Benia delighted them by carving little creatures out of wood and naming each one. He caught me watching him, and his plaintive smile told me that he had done the same for his own sons, dead long ago. Asnat did not come with us, and Joseph never spoke a word of his wife. My brother was attended by a youthful guard, all of them as beautiful as he had been in his youth, and I often saw him staring at his handsome companions wistfully. He and I barely spoke on the voyage north. We took our meals separately, and no one suspected that the carpenter's wife had anything to say to the powerful vizier. When we did exchange words, to say good morning or to comment about the children, we never spoke in our mother tongue. That might have drawn attention to his foreign birth, which was a sore point among many in the king's service. Joseph kept to himself at the prow of the bark, under a gleaming awning, wrapped in his dark cloak. Had I been alone, I might have sat like him, reliving the journey that had brought me to the house of Noctre, where I became a mother, remembering, too, the loss of my son. Had it not been for Benia, I would have thought of the impending meeting with my brothers and opened the old wounds in my heart. But Benia was always nearby, and my husband was captivated by the sights of a journey that was, for him, like the gift of an extra life. He directed my eyes at the sails in the wind, or when the air was still, at the harmony of the rowers' oars. Nothing escaped his attention, and he pointed to horizons and trees, birds in flight, men plowing the fields, wildflowers, a stand of papyrus that looked like a field of copper in the setting sun. When we came upon a herd of water horses, his excitement was matched only by that of Joseph's boys, who crowded by his side to watch the children of Tawaret splash and roar in the reeds. On the third day of the journey, I set aside my spinning and sat quietly, watching the water lap against the shore, my mind as calm and wordless as the surface of the river. I inhaled the loamy smell of the river and listened to the sound of the water on the hull, which was like a constant breeze. I trailed my fingers through the water, watching them grow wrinkled and white. "You are smiling," said Benia when he came upon me. When I was a child, I was told that I would only find contentment beside a river, I told him. But it was a false prophecy. The water soothes my heart and settles my thoughts, and it is true that I feel at home by the water, but I found my joy in dry hills, where the fountain is distant and the dust is thick. Benia squeezed my hand, and we watched Egypt pass, emerald green, while the sun sparked the water into countless points of light. In the mornings and at sunset, when the bark docked for the night, Menasheh and Ephraim would jump into the water. The servants watched for crocodiles and snakes, but my husband could not resist the boys' invitation to join them. He removed his loincloth and jumped in with a roar that was answered by childish squeals. I laughed to see my husband dive under the surface and shoot up again, like a heron, like a boy. When I told Benia of a dream in which I was a fish, he grinned and promised to make it so. So one night, under a full moon, Benia put his finger to his lips and led me down to the water's edge. Silently, he motioned for me to lie back in his arms, where he held me effortlessly, as though I were as light as a baby, and he as strong as 10 men. With his hands, he coaxed and reassured me until I put my head back and unclenched my hands and lay as though on a bed. When I relaxed, my husband released me so that I only felt his fingertips on my back while the river held me and the moonlight turned the water silver. Every night I grew bolder. I learned to float without the support of my husband's hands, and then to move on my back, facing the waning moon. He showed me how to stay on the surface and swim like a dog, kicking and kneading the water for dear life. I laughed and swallowed water. It was the first time I had frolicked like a child since my son was a baby. By the end of the journey north, I could duck my head underwater and even swim side by side with Benia. Whispering on our pallet afterward, I told him about the first time I ever saw anyone swimming, at the river on our way out of Haran. They were Egyptians, I said, remembering their voices. I wonder if they were comparing the water of that river with this, just as I am tonight. We turned to each other and made love as silently as fishes, and slept like children rocking on the bosom of the great river, source and fulfillment. At Tanis, we left the river and began the journey into the hills where the sons of Jacob lived. In Egypt, farmers and even tanners were held in higher esteem than shepherds, whose work was considered the lowest and most odious of occupations. The official purpose of Zaphnat Paneach's journey was to conduct a census of the flocks and select the finest animals for the king's table. In fact, this was a task beneath his station, the sort of thing usually assigned to a middle-ranked scribe. Still, it served my brother as an excuse to visit the relations he had not seen for 10 years, since he granted them refuge from the famine in Canaan. Traveling in Zaphnat Paneach's caravan was nothing like the journeys of my childhood. My brother was carried on a litter by his military bearers, and his sons rode donkeys behind. Benia and I, who walked, were surrounded by servants who offered cool beer or fruit if we so much as raised a hand to shade our eyes. At night, we rested on thick pallets under pure white tents. Luxury was not the only difference. This journey was very quiet, almost hushed. Joseph sat alone, his brow knit, his knuckles white on the arms of his chair. I was uneasy too, but there was no way for me to speak to Benia without being overheard. Only the sons of Joseph were carefree. Menasheh and Ephraim dubbed their donkeys Huppim and Muppim and invented stories about them. They tossed a ball back and forth between them and laughed and complained that their backsides were black and blue from riding. Had it not been for them, I might have forgotten how to smile. After 4 days, we came upon the camp where the sons of Jacob lived. I was shocked by the size of it. I had imagined a gathering like the one in Shechem, with a dozen tents and half as many cooking fires. But here was a whole village. Scores of women with covered hair scurried back and forth, carrying water jugs and firewood. Babies' cries rose up from the murmur of my mother tongue being spoken, shouted, and crooned in accents both familiar and unfamiliar. But it was the smells that brought me to tears. Onions frying in olive oil, the musky dust of the herds mixing with the perfume of baking bread. Only Benia's hand kept me from faltering. A delegation of the tribe's leaders walked forward to meet the vizier, their kinsman. Joseph faced them with his sons at his sides, flanked by his handsome guards. Behind them stood servants, bearers, and slave girls, and off to one side, a carpenter and his wife. Joseph's face was nearly white with anxiety, but he showed his teeth in a large, false smile. The sons of Jacob stood before us, but I recognized none of these old men. The eldest among them, his face deeply lined and hidden by dirty gray hair, spoke slowly, awkwardly, in the language of Egypt. He delivered formal greetings to Zaphnat Paneach, their protector and savior, the one who had brought them to the land in peace and fed them. It was only when he switched to the speech of his birth that I recognized the speaker. "In the name of our father Jacob, I welcome you, brother, to our humble tents," said Judah, who had been so beautiful in youth. "Daddy is near the end," he said. "He is not always in his own mind, and thrashes on the bed, calling for Rachel and Leah. He wakes out of a dream and curses one son, but in another hour blesses the same man with lavish praise and promises. but he has been waiting for you, Joseph, you and your sons." As Judas spoke, I began to recognize some of the men behind him. There was Dan, with his mother's black, moss-like hair, his skin still unlined, and his eyes calm as Bilhah's. It was no longer difficult to distinguish Naphtali from Issachar, for Tali was lame and Issachar stooped. Zebulun still resembled Judah, though he looked far less worn down by life. Several of the younger men, my nephews, I guessed, recalled Jacob as he had been in his youth, but I could not guess whose sons they were or which might be Benjamin. Joseph listened to Judah without once meeting his brother's eyes, which were fixed upon him. Even when Judah was finished speaking, Joseph did not reply or lift his head. Finally, Judah spoke again. "These must be your boys. What names did you give them?" "Manasseh is the older, and this is Ephraim," Joseph replied, placing his hands upon their heads in turn. Hearing their names, the boys looked up to their father, their faces shining with curiosity about what was being said in the strange-sounding tongue they had never before heard from their father's mouth. "They barely understand why we are here," Joseph said. "I do not know myself." Anger flashed across Judah's face, but it quickly changed to defeat. "There is no undoing the wrongs of the past," he said. "Still, it is good of you to give the old man a peaceful death. He lived in torment from the moment we called you dead, and he never recovered, even after he learned you were still alive." "Come," said Judah, "let us go and see if our father is awake, or will you eat and drink first?" "No," Joseph answered, "better to do it." Taking his sons by the hand, Joseph followed Judah to the tent where Jacob lay dying. I stood with the rest of Zaphnath-Paneah's servants and retainers, watching as they disappeared into the dusty village. I was fixed to the earth, trembling, furious that not one of them knew me. But I was relieved, too. Beniah led me gently to where the servants were setting up tents for the evening, and we waited there. There was barely time to number my feelings before Joseph reappeared, with Manasseh and Ephraim, their eyes fixed on the ground in fear. My brother strode past me and into his tent without a word. Beniah could not coax me to eat that night, and although I lay down beside him, I did not close my eyes. I stared into darkness and let the past wash over me as it would. I remembered Reuben's kindness and Judah's beauty. I remembered Dan's voice and song, and the way Gad and Asher mimicked our grandfather until I collapsed in laughter. I remembered how Issa and Tali wept when Levi and Simon tormented them and said they were interchangeable in their mother's eyes. I remember how Judah once tickled me until I peed, but never told a soul. I remembered how Reuben used to carry me on his shoulders from where I could touch the clouds. Finally, I could lie still no longer and walked out into the night where Joseph waited for me, pacing by the side of my tent. We walked away from the camp slowly, for there was no moon, and darkness covered everything. After some distance, Joseph flung himself onto the ground and told me what had happened. "At first he did not know me," my brother said. "Daddy whimpered like a tired child, crying, 'Joseph, where is Joseph?' I said, 'Here I am.' But still he asked, 'Where is my son Joseph? Why does he not come?' I put my mouth to his ear and said, 'Joseph is here with his sons, just as you asked.' After many such exchanges, he suddenly understood and grabbed at my face, my hands, my robes. Weeping, he repeated my name over and over and begged forgiveness of me and of my mother. He cursed the memory of Levi and Simon and Reuben, too. Then he wailed because he had not forgiven his firstborn. He named each of my brothers in turn, blessing them and cursing them, turning them into animals, sighing over their boyhood pranks, calling out to their mothers to wipe their bottoms. 'How horrid to grow old like that,' said Joseph, with pity and disgust in his voice. I pray I die before the day comes when I do not know if my sons are infants or grandfathers. Jacob seemed to sleep, but after a moment he called out again, Where is Joseph? As though he had not already kissed me. Here am I answered. Let me bless the boys, said Jacob. Let me see them now. My sons trembled at my side. The tent stank with his illness, and his ranting had frightened them. But I told them that their grandfather wished to bless them, and I pushed them toward him, one on either side. He put his right hand on Ephraim's head, and his left hand on Manasseh's. He blessed them in the name of Abram and Isaac, then sat up and roared, Remember me! They shrank back and hid behind me. I told Jacob his grandsons' names, but he did not hear me. He stared, sightless, at the roof of the tent, and spoke to Rachel, apologizing for abandoning her bones at the side of a road. He wept for his beloved, and begged her to let him die in peace. He did not notice when I left with my sons. As Joseph spoke, I felt an old heaviness return to my heart, and recognized the weight I had carried during my years in Noctre's house. The burden was not made of sorrow, as I had thought. It was anger that rose out of me and found its lost voice. What of me, I said? Did he mention me? Did he repent of what he did to me? Did he speak of the murder of Shechem? Did he weep for the innocent blood of Shalem and Hamor? Did he repent for the slaughter of his own honor? There was silence from the ground where Joseph lay. He said nothing of you. Dinah is forgotten in the house of Jacob. His words should have laid me low, but they did not. I left Joseph on the ground and stumbled back to the camp by myself. I was suddenly exhausted, and every step was an effort. But my eyes were dry. After Joseph arrived, Jacob stopped eating and drinking. His death would come within hours, days at the most, so we waited. I passed the time sitting at the door of my tent, spinning linen, studying the children of Leah, Rachel, Zilpah, and Bilhah. I saw my mother's smiles and gestures and heard their laughter. Some of the connections were as clear as daylight. I recognized an exact copy of Bilhah and what had to be Dan's daughter. Another little girl wore my Aunt Rachel's hair. Leah's sharp nose was evident everywhere. On the second day of Jacob's death watch, a girl approached, a basket of fresh bread in her hands. She introduced herself in the language of Egypt as Gerah, the daughter of Benjamin, and his Egyptian wife Neset. Gerah was curious to discover how a woman of my status sat and spun, while the others who attended Zaphnat Paneach cooked and fetched and cleaned all day. I told my sisters that you must be nurse to the sons of the vizier, my uncle, she said. Is it so? Did I guess well? I smiled and said, You made a good guess, and asked her to sit down and tell me of her sisters and brothers. Gerah accepted my invitation with a satisfied grin, and began to lay out the warp and weft of her family. My sisters are still children, said the girl, herself still a few years away from womanhood. We have twins, Muzah and Nahamah, who are too young even to spin. My father, Benjamin, had sons in Canaan, as well as by another wife who died. My brothers are called Bela, Becher, Ehi, and Ard, and they are good enough fellows, though I do not know them any better than the sons of my uncles, who are as numerous as our flocks and just as noisy, she said, and winked at me as though we were old friends. You have many uncles, I said. 11, Gerah said, but the three oldest are dead. Ah, I nodded, bidding farewell to Reuben in my heart. My niece settled in beside me, drawing a spindle from her apron and setting to work as she unraveled the skein of our family's history. The eldest was Reuben, son of Leah, my grandfather's first wife. The scandal there is that Reuben was found lying with Bilhah, the youngest of Jacob's wives. Jacob never forgave his firstborn, even after Bilhah died, even though Reuben gave him grandsons and more wealth than the rest of the brothers combined. They say my uncle wept for Jacob's forgiveness when he died, but his father would not come to him. Simon and Levi, also born of Leah, were murdered in Tanis when I was a baby. No one knows the whole tale there, but among the women, there is talk that the two of them tried to get the better of a traitor in some small matter. For their victim, they chose the most ruthless cutthroat in Egypt, who killed them for their greed. Terah looked up and saw Judah walking into Jacob's tent. Uncle Judah, son of Leah, has been clan leader for many years. He is a fair man and bears the burdens of the family well, though some of my cousins think he's grown too cautious in his old age. Terah went on, teaching me the story of my brothers and their wives, pointing out their children, reciting the names of nieces and nephews, flesh of my flesh, with whom I would never exchange a word. Reuben had three sons with a wife named Zillah. His second wife, Atar, bore him two girls, Bina and Ephrat. Simon had five sons by the odious Elutu, whom Gerah remembered as an awful scold with bad breath. He had another son by a Shechemite woman, but that one walked into a flooded wadi and drowned. "My mother says he killed himself," said Gerah in a whisper. "That man over there is called Merari," she said. "The miracle in him is that he is a good fellow, despite the fact that he was born to Levi and Inbu. His brothers are as bad as their father was." A slack-jawed man shuffled up to Gerah, who handed him a bit of bread and sent him away. "That was Shelah," she explained, "Judah's son by Shua. He is feeble-minded but sweet. My uncle had a second wife named Tamar, who gave him Peretz and Zerach, and my best friend Daphna. She is the beauty of my family in this generation." "Over there is Hesia," she said, nodding to a woman nearly my own age, "wife of Issachar, son of Leah. Hesia is the mother of three sons and Tola, who has taken up the midwife's life. If Daphna is heir to Rachel's beauty, Tola has her golden hands." "Who is Rachel?" I asked, hoping to hear more of my aunt. "That is your master's mother," she said, surprised at my ignorance. "Though I suppose there is no reason for you to know her name. Rachel was the second wife, Jacob's beloved, the beauty. She died giving birth to Benjamin, my father." I nodded and patted her hand, seeing the shape of Rachel's fingers there. "Go on, dear," I said. "Tell me more. I like the sound of your family's names." "Dan was the only son of Bilhah," Gerah said. "She was Jacob's third wife, Rachel's handmaid, and the one who lay with Reuben. Dan has three daughters by Timnah, named Edna, Tirza, and Beret. All of them are kind-hearted women. They are the ones who tend to Jacob. Zilpah was the fourth wife, handmaiden to Leah, and she bore twins. The first was Gad, who loved his wife Sarah Imnah with a great love. But she died giving birth to her fourth child, her first daughter, Sarah, who is gifted with song," said Gerah. "Asher, Gad's twin brother, married Orit," she continued. "Their eldest was a daughter, Areli, who gave birth to a daughter last week, the newest soul in the family, whose name is Nina. Leah's Naphtali fathered six children upon Yedidah, whose daughters are Elisheva and Vania. And of course you know the sons of Joseph better than anyone," Gerah said. "He has no daughters?" she asked. "Not yet," I replied. Gerah caught sight of two young women, and pointing at me, nodded her head emphatically. "Those are two of the daughters of Zebulun, son of Leah. Their mother, Ahava, produced six girls who are their own little tribe. I like it when they include me in their circle. It's a merry group. Liora, Mahalat, Gia, Yara, Noadia, and Yael," she said, counting out their names on her fingers. "They have the best gossip. It was they who told me the story of the Shechemite woman's son who killed himself. He went mad," she said, lowering her voice, "when he learned the terrible circumstances of his birth. What could have caused him such despair? I asked. It's an ugly tale, she replied coyly, leaning in to whet my interest. Those often make for the best stories, I answered. Very well, Garas said, setting down her spinning and looking me straight in the eye. According to Auntie Ahava's story, Leia had one daughter who lived. She must have been a great beauty, for she was taken in marriage by a Shehemite nobleman, a prince, in fact, the son of King Hamor. The king brought Jacob a handsome bride price with his own hands, but it wasn't enough for Simon and Levi. They claimed that their sister had been kidnapped and raped, and that the family honor was demeaned. They put up such a noise that the king, bowing to his son's great passion for Leia's daughter, doubled the bride price. Still, my uncles were not satisfied. They claimed it was a plot of the Canaanites to take what was Jacob's and make it Hamor's. So Levi and Simon tried to undo the marriage by demanding that the Shehemites give up their foreskins and become Jacobites. Now comes the part of this story that makes me think it is nothing more than a tale that girls tell each other. The prince submitted to the knife. He and his father and all the men in the city. My cousins say this is impossible, because men are not capable of such love. In the story, though, the prince agreed. He and the men of the city were circumcised. Garah lowered her voice, setting a dark tone for the sorrowful ending. 2 nights after the cutting, while the men of the city groaned in pain, Levi and Simon stole into the city and slaughtered the prince, the king, and all the men they found within its gates. They took the livestock and the women of the city, too, which is how Simon came to have a Shehemite wife. When their son learned about his father's villainy, he drowned himself. My eyes had been fixed upon my spindle as she recounted the tale. And what of the sister, I asked, the one who was loved by the prince? That is a mystery, said Garah. I think she died of grief. Sarah made up a song about her being gathered by the Queen of Heaven and turned into a falling star. Is her name remembered? I asked softly. Dina, she said. I like the sound of it, don't you? Someday, if I am delivered of a daughter, I will call her Dina. Garah said nothing more about Leia's daughter and prattled on about feuds and love affairs among her cousins. She chatted until late in the afternoon before thinking to ask about me, and by then I could excuse myself, for it was time for the evening meal. Jacob died that night. I heard one woman sobbing and wondered who among his daughters-in-law wept for the old man. Benia folded me in his arms, but I felt neither grief nor anger. Garah had given me peace. The story of Dina was too terrible to be forgotten. As long as the memory of Jacob lived, my name would be remembered. The past had done its worst to me, and I had nothing to fear of the future. I left the house of Jacob better comforted than Joseph. In the morning, Judah prepared to take Jacob's body to lie with his fathers in Canaan. Joseph watched as they lifted his bones onto his gold-covered litter, which he gave for the funeral voyage. Before Judah left to put his father into the ground, he and Joseph embraced for the last time. I turned away from the sight, but before I reached my tent, I felt a hand on my shoulder and turned to face Judah, whose expression was a map of uncertainty and shame. He held out a fist to me. "It was our mother's," he said, struggling to speak. "When she died, she called me to her and said to give this to her daughter." "I thought she was out of her mind," said Judah, "but she foresaw our meeting. Our mother never forgot you, and although Jacob forbade it, she spoke of you every day until she died. Take this from our mother, Leia, and may you know peace," he said, pressing something in my hand before walking away, his head hung low. I looked down to see Rachel's lapis ring, Jacob's first gift to her. At first I thought to call Judah back and ask him why my mother had sent me the token of Jacob's love for her sister. But of course, he would have no way of knowing. It was good to see the river again. After the heat of the hills, the embrace of the Nile was sweet and cool. And at night, in Benia's arms, I told him all that I had heard from Gerah and showed him the ring. I puzzled over its meaning and prayed for a dream to explain the mystery, but it was Benia who gave me the answer. Holding my hand to the light and peering at it with eyes practiced at seeing beauty, he said, "Perhaps your mother meant it as a token that she had forgiven her sister. Maybe it was a sign that she died with an undivided heart and wished the same for you." My husband's words found their mark, and I recalled something that Zilpah had told me when I was a child in the red tent and far too young to understand her meaning. "We are all born of the same mother," she said. After a lifetime, I knew that to be true. Although the journey was uneventful and my hands were idle, I was exhausted by the trip home. I longed to return to my own house, to see Shifrei and Kia's baby, who had been born during my absence. I was terribly restless during the 3 days' stop in Memphis, but kept my impatience to myself because of Benia. He returned from the marketplace every evening, overflowing with the beauty he had seen. He exclaimed at the silkiness of the olive wood, the pure black of the ebony, the aromatic cedars. He brought back scraps of pine and taught Joseph's sons to carve. He bought me a gift, too, a pitcher in the shape of a grinning Tawaret that made me smile every time I looked at her. The vizier's bark trailed a barge laden with fine timbers when we sailed out of Memphis for the last part of the journey to Thebes. Joseph and I said goodbye in the darkness of the last night. "There was no need for sorrow at our parting," he said lightly. "This is only a farewell. If Asnat bears again, we will call for you." But I knew we would not meet again. "Joseph," I said, "it is out of our hands." "Be well," I whispered, touching his cheek with a hand that bore his mother's ring. "I will think of you." "I will think of you too," he replied softly. In the morning, Benia and I eagerly turned to the west. Once home, we resumed the order of our days. Kia's new son was good-natured, and he learned to crow happily when his mother handed him to me on nights she went to attend at a birth. I rarely accompanied her past sunset, though, for I was growing old. My feet ached in the morning, and my hands were stiff. But still, I counted myself lucky that I was neither feeble nor dull. I had strength enough for my house and to care for Benia. He remained strong and sure, his eye ever clear, his love for his work and his love for me as constant as the sun. My last years were good ones. Kia had two more babies, another boy and a girl, who took over my house and my husband's heart. We received countless sweet-breathed kisses every day. "You are the elixir of youth," I said, as I tickled them and laughed with them. "You sustain these old bones. You keep me alive." But not even the devotion of little children can stave off death forever, and my time arrived. I did not suffer long. I woke in the night to feel a crushing weight on my chest. But after the first shock, there was no pain. Benia held my face between his great warm hands. Kia arrived and cradled my feet between her long fingers. They wept, and I could not form the words to comfort them. Then they changed before my eyes, and I had no words to describe what I saw. My beloved turned into a beacon as bright as the sun, and his light warmed me through and through. Kia glowed like the moon and sang with the green and solemn voice of the Queen of the Night. In the darkness surrounding the shining lights of my life, I began to discern the faces of my mothers each one burning with her own fire. Leah, Rachel, Zilpah, and Bilhah. Inna, Rhenefer, and Merit. Even poor Rudy and arrogant Rebecca were arrayed to meet me. Although I had never seen them, I recognized Ada and Sarai as well. Strong, brave, wonderstruck, kind, gifted, broken, loyal, foolish, talented, weak. Each one welcoming me in her way. Oh, I cried in wonder. Benia held me even tighter and sobbed. He thought that I suffered, but I felt nothing but excitement at the lessons that death held out to me. In the moment before I crossed over, I knew that the priests and magicians of Egypt were fools and charlatans for promising to prolong the beauties of life beyond the world we are given. Death is no enemy, but the foundation of gratitude, sympathy, and art. Of all life's pleasures, only love owes no debt to death. "Thank you, beloved," I said to Benia, but he did not hear me. "Thank you, daughter," I said to Kia, who had put her ear to my chest, and hearing nothing, started to keen. I died, but I did not leave them. Benia sat beside me, and I stayed in his eye and in his heart. For weeks and months and years, my face lived in the garden, my scent clung to the sheets. For as long as he lived, I walked with him by day and lay down with him at night. When his eyes closed for the last time, I thought perhaps I would finally leave the world. But even then, I lingered. Shifre sang the song I taught her, and Kia moved with my motions. Joseph thought of me when his daughter was born. Gerah named her baby Dina. Ramos married and told his wife about the mother who had sent him away so that he would not die but live. Ramos's children bore children unto the 100th generation. Some of them live in the land of my birth, and some in the cold and windy places that Werenro described by the light of my mother's fire. There is no magic to immortality. In Egypt, I loved the perfume of the lotus. A flower would bloom in the pool at dawn, filling the entire garden with a blue musk so powerful it seemed that even the fish and ducks would swoon. By night, the flower might wither, but the perfume lasted, fainter and fainter, but never quite gone. Even many days later, the lotus remained in the garden. Months would pass, and a bee would alight near the spot where the lotus had blossomed, and its essence was released again, momentary but undeniable. Egypt loved the lotus because it never dies. It is the same for people who are loved. Thus can something as insignificant as a name, two syllables, one high, one sweet, summon up the innumerable smiles and tears, sighs, and dreams of a human life. If you sit on the bank of a river, you see only a small part of its surface. And yet, the water before your eyes is proof of unknowable depths. My heart brims with thanks for the kindness you have shown me by sitting on the bank of this river, by visiting the echoes of my name. Blessings on your eyes and on your children. Blessings on the ground beneath you. Wherever you walk, I go with you. Selah.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.